I want to share with you this morning my experience in the area of assimilation. It's funny, I was doing it but never knew the word until sometime later on, but we were heavily involved in it at Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where I was on loan from the Navigators to assist that church in its assimilation ministry for 7 years. I was there from 1972 to 1979, and some of you, I think all of you are familiar, that is the mother church where Evangelism Explosion was born. And there were a number of things that we had to do in order to fold people, to bring them into the vital relationship and membership in the church. And being Navigator trained, I ended up there simply because Dr. Kennedy had written to the Navigators and said, "We need help desperately. Could you send a couple to come help us in the area of follow-up and discipling?" And that's what we were calling it. And but it is also assimilation, folding people into the local church. And I had come from a background of 16 years of working in the United States military ministry of the Navigators. I had worked with collegiates in Charleston, South Carolina at the Citadel. You're probably familiar with that place, the old Military College of South Carolina. We had a very, very successful ministry there. I took it over with six guys, and in 3 years we had about 150 regularly in Bible study. Very growing ministry. I remember distinctly the last year we were there, we had 92 professions of faith on the campus, and we had 70% of those being assimilated. It's a new word, you know. They were being folded into the group and feeling part of it. While I was there, several things came out of this. By the way, did you give out those handouts? Let's give a handouts to everybody, and we'll follow. I have those for you. We got a lot of things we're going to try to tie together and show you this. I came aboard the staff of the church from my background as a Navigator representative, working with collegiates, with community people, with military. And I knew what worked among military guys and collegiates and others. I knew what worked, particularly in those two areas. If we had led someone to Christ on a military base and we told him there was a Bible study for him Tuesday evening, say in the chapel annex, and we wanted him there, there was a pretty good possibility we could get him there. But once you move into community ministry and you lead somebody to Christ, the most difficult thing I've ever run into was to get a person out of their house into the church on a Sunday morning. That's extremely difficult. And so when I first got there, there were a number of other things that were going on as a result of the evangelism explosion. Every week at Coral Ridge Church, there was anywhere between 35 to 50 or 75 or even more new professions of faith every single week. That's a lot of people to try to take and make sure that we're going to do the best we can to bring them into a vital relationship with the local church, which happened to be Coral Ridge. And that was my job. And I was trying to figure out between what I knew worked with military and what worked with collegiates, could it work in the local church? And as a result of that, I looked over what we were doing in military and discovered there were 18 major principles that we were teaching a serviceman to help him grow and become established in his faith. But I suddenly realized there was no way in a local church that I could suddenly ask a brand new Christian to come to a class and teach him for 18 weeks. That's just overwhelming. So I began to investigate what was being done in other places. And I discovered that some churches had discovery classes of 1 week. Some of them had discovery classes of 2 weeks length. And some of them had them 6, 8, 10. Most of them, a lot of them, were 16 weeks long. And knowing what principles I needed to communicate, I knew that I could not ask any brand new Christian to commit themselves to come to a particular class where we could begin to help them become established in their faith that was so long. It had to be shortened. And so I came up with 8 lessons, and I began to teach the course called the Discovery Class, and as a result of that, this was born. And some of you have seen this. Some of you probably have read it. Today, hundreds and hundreds of churches across the United States use this as the source for their discovery classes for new believers. It has the 8 lessons in it. We began to teach it. We had all kinds of things that we did to help them feel at home. Anybody that came to the class could come brand new to the class all the way up to lesson number 4. After that, we had to recycle and wait till they could come in again with class number 1. And when I started the class, it never ended. Every 8 weeks, I'm back on class number 1 and begin a new cycle of 8 more classes. And this was in the church structure, and I'm going to share with you the avenues through which people came to this. In the church structure, it was listed as the mandatory class for the adults. It was the first one. That's where you came. I've always been concerned, and I'm sure you men are too, and women are too, that a person comes to Christ, and we have our structures in our local church concerning membership and other things like that. And so often, so many people head toward a pew, and that's where they'll sit for 40 years. No more than that. Realizing our responsibility is to disciple people, to establish them in the faith, I did everything I could to make sure those principles were being communicated. And we began that way. And the 8 lessons, I'll just share what they are so you can get a general idea. Class number 1 was knowing that you have eternal life. It was a rehash of the gospel for half of the class, and the instrument God used to bring you to a relationship with Him. And then the second half was, how do you know you have it? And I bring in a lot of my own personal experience in there, and I believe there are 6 or 7 ways that we can know that we have eternal life. Class number 2 was the importance of the Bible in our daily life. And so I communicated, why did God give us the Scripture? And then I talked about how we got our Bible and things of that nature. At the end of that class, we went on into the third class, was how do we discover biblical truths? And that's the old navigator hand illustration. You know what that one is. Hear, read, study, memorize, and meditate. How we learn it. And I backed all that up. In this particular class, it was the first class where we shifted from come listen to a place where we offered them something that would begin to help them become established in their faith. And it happened to be the little Beginning with Christ memory packet. I shared how it helped me way back in 1951. And I shared, it's available on the table over there. If you want to pitch in 25 cents to pay for it, fine. But we want you to take that. And I taught them how to memorize Scripture in that class. And the next week, I just simply asked, how many of you memorized that verse? And it's amazing. We didn't require them to memorize the verse, but a lot of people were beginning to do it. Then the next class was how to spend personal time with God. That's your devotional time. And we went into that, looked at a lot of history in the background. Then it was the church and Christian fellowship. And usually in this particular class, I would share that in 2 weeks, we're going to have an official membership class starting in the church. And we encourage you to come. You don't have to join the church, but if you'd like to come and see what's offered and then take it in, then you can make your decision whether you want to join the church or not. And Dr. Kennedy taught those classes every Sunday evening after the worship service for 4 weeks in a row. The 5th week, it was the reception by the elders into the church, and I'll tell you more things. I got a lot of cover on that area. Then we went into chapter 6, or lesson 6, was the Lordship of Jesus Christ in the believer's life. I felt that this is the most critical teaching biblically that a new Christian needs to know, is to learn to surrender your life to Christ and let Him lead you. Then we move from there into the chapter on becoming Christ's disciple. And what does it mean to become a disciple? And I'm going to show you some charts this morning where all that tied together. I did some very, very brief things so it wouldn't overwhelm them. And then the last one is God's plan for a committed disciple's life. That were the 8 lessons. And I was teaching it 3.5 years before this was published. There were so many demands. We had about 450, close to 500 pastors request my outlines as they would come for the Evangelism Explosion training clinics at the church. They would often visit many classes, and I kept getting demands for the outlines. And so this was born as a result of that. And as I said, today, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of churches across the United States use that as a new believer class material. Some churches are small, and they can only have 1 or 2 classes maybe in the spring and 1 or 2 classes maybe in the fall. Coral Ridge was so big and so heavy, we'd go up to 100, 120 in the class, or we'd drop down in the summer to maybe 20 or so, and it would continue that way. As a result of that, I had to go on and move into another area, and this one was another one that followed, and this one's the Essentials of Discipleship. Again, I was teaching these courses long before we even thought about writing books on them. They were, this is the exact teaching that I was, the classes that I was teaching. It was transcribed from the tapes and then editorial and went into that one. I wrote with that one, the companion, the Bible study that matches it. And this one deals with the profile of a disciple. I will show you that on the overhead in just a moment. But these were born, and I have them available here at the end of the class today. I'll tell you a little bit more about them. But this was our problem. We had so many people coming to Christ, we had to at least communicate that the very best possible follow-up was available to them. Now, it was up to them to take it. We worked the channels several ways. We worked through the evangelist in evangelism explosion, bringing their new converts to the class. We also provided a little card in their packets that they would give to every person that made a profession of faith, telling about the class so they could have that and just give it to them. And that worked quite well. Now, when people would come, I would greet them at the door and welcome them, and we would spend our time, the first few minutes or so, every class, because they're brand new, we encourage them to meet somebody else in the class, spend 5 minutes getting acquainted. And this kind of helped people to begin to feel part of what we were doing. And that's assimilation at its bottom line. It's beginning to take place. Because it's so easy to come to a church. You can visit a church, come into the worship service, walk out the door, maybe shake hands with a pastor, never talk to anybody, and they feel like something's missing. Well, we tried in the class, at least, to do the very best. Now, the channels to my class, let me just give you a number of these. One was the new membership class. They would come from the new membership class, and during the fifth week of that class, we had another class we call VIM, and it's Vitally Informed Members. What that meant, everybody in any area of responsibility in the church would come and would share what that ministry was to people. The people in the choir were there. I was there because I established all the home Bible studies, and I would tell about that, and I'd send around a clipboard. If you want to get into a home Bible study, please sign up. I'll contact you. I'll try to find a good class for you and get you in. Then we had that avenue, and of course they would tell about all their things, and we would mention in the Sunday school department, as adults, we wanted you to go to the Essentials of New Life class as a starting point, and they would come in. That's one source. The other source was all the converts coming in from evangelism explosion, number two. The third source is people you led to Christ in your private life, and we encourage them to bring them in. And I committed myself, I trained others to substitute for me when I was out of town, but I committed myself to care for that new babe for at least 8 weeks with individual help and instruction and things that anything I could provide for them. We worked on that right there, and we tied it together. I think that's basically the way it all came together. But there was a dilemma, and the dilemma we faced was that constant flow. Every week there are new people, and so we had to restructure that. At one time, we had two of these classes running simultaneously. When I got to the fourth, they could still come in, but by the fifth week, we'd start the second one, and we had a cycle between two of them. Now, you can run it another way. You can figure out a way to do it. By the way, there was a leader's guide with the first one. It went out of print. I still have a master. If you want a copy of that, I can Xerox it and give you one. I'd be happy to do that. The process that we used, as I mentioned, was to funnel them in through all these many avenues in the church. Now, we face a number of major questions when it comes to assimilation. First, the logical question is, how can we reach more people with the good news of the gospel? How can we do that? And I think you've been hearing so much from Frank and from Jim Peterson and Jerry White, and I'm sure even in all the others. That's one of the things that we're fighting with, always the outreach of the local church. We should always keep that. I know as a navigator, a representative, one of the highest priorities I had was to keep evangelism absolutely one of the strongest that I had, because God would give us the solution to handle the new babes. When we were in Japan, we were there 4 years, And I was directing a servicemen center that I had been in my days in the Navy. Never dreamed that 10 years later on that God would lead me back there. But in the 4 years we were there, we had 800 professions of faith. That's a lot of guys. And one of the reasons I believe that's so is because I believe in the principle of training a new convert as soon as possible to share his faith, because the result of that is you literally hook him for the rest of his life. And he doesn't become the mass that are in our churches that have never shared Christ with anybody. And so that's why you'll see it. So there is that, how can we reach more people? So you keep evangelism extremely strong. Number two, how can we bring them into vital membership in a local church? We were leading a lot of people to Christ that never did become a member of Coral Ridge. They told us very clearly that they didn't want to do so. I was responsible in the areas of follow-up and assimilation in the church to provide to the membership office information from Evangelism Explosion of every single person that had been led to Christ, whether they were interested in joining the church or not, so that we could send them a letter that the next new member class was coming at a certain time. There were a lot of clues to that. One, the new convert continued to return to the worship services. That's a clue that they're interested. But the other one was to go to the evangelist and say, well, now, Jim, I noticed in the records that you led Mr. and Mrs. Smith to Christ about 4 weeks ago. And you know a new membership class is coming up, and I just want to know, have you ever talked to them about the possibility of maybe joining our church? And he said, yes, we have. In fact, they've even brought it up. We've talked, and they're very interested. I said, well, okay, we'll turn their name in so they can receive an invitation to come to the new membership classes. So you're constantly struggling with that dilemma of how can we bring them into vital membership? We all know, I remember years ago in the 50s when I heard Doss Trotman, he spoke about delivering a sermon many, many, many years ago. And I believe he said it was taught, he spoke this at Bob Jones University in the Southeast sometime, and the title of the message was, Don't Leave Your Baby on My Doorstep. You see, he's concerned about bringing them into vital membership or vital relationship with other Christians so they can grow. We're always dealing with the same thing. Another thing we face is how can we help them to feel more a part of the church and at home there? How can you make them feel a part of it and at home there? And the last one is how can we keep them from going out the back door or dropping into an inactive role? And every church struggles with that. Every church and its leadership are constantly grappling with these questions since assimilation deals with the outreach of an existing congregation to the people of their community that are not actively involved in the life of any worshiping congregation. That's the reason why we're concerned about it. There are some proven methods of recruitment and assimilation that do work, and all I can speak to, of course, is from my own experience of what happened. While I was there, personally, I was able to bring into vital membership at Coral Ridge over 250 people into the membership of the church. Jim Kennedy made it very clear to all of us, there were 11 of us on staff there with him as ministers, and one time in a staff meeting, he said, gentlemen, I want to get something clear with all of you. I am not the only one building this church. You're also equally involved. And he put pressure on us and he said, I want you to bring 5 new members into this church every single new membership class. Man, I tell you, you know what happened? You suddenly began to realize, I've got a 24-hour project that I never get away from, and you live with it. And as I lead people to Christ, and I began to get them into my discovery class, and I'm going to talk about Bible studies we got them into, and all the other things we did with them, we would finally say, well, John and Mary, are you considering joining the church? And I'm working on it. I list down that John and Mary Smith were, you know, a couple that I had recruited. They're going to join the church. And so during those years, I was able to bring 250 people into membership. It relates to follow-up, and that's where I have been, and it's closely related there. And I just want to show this to you. I've given you some of the overheads. I didn't give them all to you, but I just want to show you the process. This, of course, you're very familiar with, I'm sure, the process of evangelism producing converts, and then we want to make growing Christians out of them. That's our first objective. I'm going to show it to you in a larger form. You should have that one. I believe I did give this one away to you. The process from convert to growing Christian is roughly 3 to 4 months. And I'm going to show you some things in there. And then from there, we want to help them become full-fledged disciples. And that's going to take anywhere from 1.5 to 2 years. And in that, a lot of things are involved. And then the disciples, we want to train them, of course, to become disciple makers. A lot's going on there. This is the same thing, but it's blown up, and I just want to explain it a little clearer to you. And that is, we have up here a training objective for a brand new Christian. This is what I was concerned with, and I think you can see that from my Essentials of New Life. I was concerned about establishing that new Christian, first helping him come to a clear understanding of his conversion. Does he understand what's happened to him? Secondly, does he have assurance of his salvation? Does he know for sure that he has the gift of eternal life? Then bring him to a meaningful quiet time. That's a process of helping them to learn how to feed upon the Word of God. It's a process that continues on. Then bring them to a place of meaningful Bible study and Scripture memory. Get them into the Word so they're studying and they're memorizing. And then we want to bring them to a place of meaningful fellowship where they're in a group of other believers where they feel welcome and loved and part of it. And any issues they're beginning to deal with, because of the relationships that develop in that relation, in that situation, they find great help in those areas there. It takes basically 3 to 4 months. And at the end of it, of course, we have the profile. He has met the profile. They are there now. And, of course, following that, we begin to add the others that relate to Lordship of Christ and helping the person become a disciple. And when we get to that, roughly 2 years down the line, this is what should be true right here. And that's my second book. I'm writing the third one now, which will be The Essentials of Disciple Making. And it'll follow with that. What are those principles, when applied, will help a person to be an effective disciple maker? And we're running here with these. I'm sorry, say that again. This one here, no, I didn't make it. I'll copy it and get them to you. But it's in the book. They're all in the book. Yeah, they're in there. Maybe I thought that through the right way. Huh? Okay. And, of course, the end result, of course, is this. Converts is a result of evangelizing. Basic disciples, the result of establishing. Equipping is helping disciples to become functioning disciples. They're involved. And then there is the multiplying. That's your leadership in the sense of disciple makers and leaders of disciple making. Laborers is exporting. We got some more on that. So this all goes together basically like this. And that's what I use to communicate. That's where I was. Now let's talk more specifically about assimilation. I think it's in your outline. I know I have it in there. The assumptions. There are seven of them. Seven majors. And I didn't list them there. I figured I'd walk them one by one and go through. The first assumption is that most congregations have the potential for a net growth of about 5% per year. A net growth of 5%. The seminar that's being taught by Bob Forbes on church evaluation, there are what we call data norms as far as church growth is concerned and the percentage of growth. And it's very interesting in the churches that have been evaluated to take a look at them and see how much sustained growth they have had over the years. I was in one in Houston, Texas last year that has been consistently averaging about 15%, which is fantastic growth. Carl Ridge, when I was there, we were growing about 750 members a year, about that. Our church downtown, where we're members, First Press, is growing about 400, 450 a year. It's an old church established in 1872, but it's very strong and true. Almost anywhere in the United States, there is enough people not actively related to any congregation to make that possible. The second assumption, and it's amazing how we overlook and don't even recognize this, but it's good. That's what I want to emphasize. It's good for people to identify themselves as Christians and to be part of a local congregation. Each individual who relates this way to a local church has the opportunity to express their Christian commitment through that local church. It's good for that. That's an assumption. The third assumption is it is not Christian to invite a person to join a local congregation and then not invite them into the fellowship of that church. I'm sure we'll get more into that. But the process of an entrance into a congregation, acceptance and assimilation all go together. Many members of local churches do not feel a sense of belonging to the congregation of which they are members. They don't feel that. In many churches, it's easier to become a member than to be accepted and made to feel so. Isn't that amazing? We tried to do everything we could to accept people. I remember I led a young girl named Betty Hoyt to Christ in my office, and a unique experience. And one of the fellows in our church was going down a major street in Fort Lauderdale and heard this girl screaming, looked over and saw two guys beating her up. And he went to her help. There were others while I'm watching. Nobody wanted to do anything, but he went to her help. I still don't know how he got her to come with him, but she did end up at the church. It was policy in the church that every one of us on staff, we were never to turn down anybody that wanted to talk to a minister. And the only excuse that we had that was valid was that we were currently talking to somebody. You couldn't say, I'm sorry, I got to teach a class tonight, I'm trying to prepare. The receptionist would go down the line, and she'd finally find somebody that says, send them up, I'll be glad to talk. And we always were to be available that type of way. Well, she called me, and I said, yes, send her up. He walks in, and she's got a washcloth in her hand, and I could see it must have had ice in it, and she had it over her eye like this. When she let it down, it was brutally bruised from being beaten up. I tried to find out what's happened and discovered that these guys were beating her up. She had been living with one of these guys. She wasn't married to him. She was living to him. She decided to leave. And the only assumption I could have is that, well, if I can't have her, nobody else is going to have her. So he beat her up. While I'm doing this, these two guys come to the church. I didn't know them, but she knew them. Now, the beautiful thing about my desk, underneath the center dress drawer, was a little white box. And all I had to do was reach under and squeeze it. It would ring in the police station down the street. There was another little one right over the ceiling. Many people asked what it is, and I said, well, that's a fire alarm. I was telling the truth, but it was far more than that. And never used it in the 7 years of it. I don't know if anybody else used it. We got into the gospel, led this young girl to Christ, and I said, by the way, I got a class for you on Sunday morning. I want you there. So she came to my class. She was consistently there. In fact, my secretary got involved in providing housing for her that night. But I invited her to class. She showed up. And we got going, and she said, Francis, can I join the church? I said, certainly you can join the church. She went into membership, and just right after that, she came to me and said, Francis, could I be your trainee in Evangelism Explosion the next semester? It was starting in a couple of weeks, so she became my trainee. And I was able to train her, and the multiplication took place from that one young girl. It was unbelievable. And this is the acceptance I'm talking about, bringing her in. Now, here she had a child out of wedlock and a rough situation, and God, in His grace, brought her to Christ, and there are so many more like that. But that's what we're talking about. Making them feel at home, feel a part of us. And it's different in a huge church like Carl Lynch. Way different. They can come and kind of nobody notices them. But if they want to become a part, and we want them to become a part, we got to do something to make that so. Another assumption, this one I believe is number 4, is evangelism is not the same as reaching out and receiving new members. It's not the same. Many new Christians have so many doubts and uncertainties that they are afraid of involvement they don't understand. Too often, this process of assimilation is unrelated to the evangelistic proclamation, but it ought to go on, it ought to continue. Number 5 is an assumption. There is a difference between what God expects of His church and what God expects of each individual local congregation. Every church, or each church rather, can only handle what God expects of them, and it's not the total responsibility. In other words, what's my part? We're part of the body of Christ in a given city and all these other churches that are here, and all we can do is what God expects of us. Now, a number 6 it should be, and that is nearly every congregation has two barriers around it. There are automatically two barriers. There is, number 1, the larger outer barrier is composed of the methods, techniques, and traditions that have the combined effect of keeping new members from joining. Secondly, there is the unintentional exclusionary barrier of the congregation. For example, the nature of the people who are members. Secondly, the history and traditions of that church. The design of its meeting place can be a barrier, and its congregational lifestyle can become a barrier. Every one of us, I know I have gone to churches and visited, and after being there for one service in the church, I determined I'd never go back again. Didn't feel comfortable. Those are they're unintentional, but they're exclusionary barriers. Then the last one, every congregation has a system of reaching, receiving, and accepting, plus assimilating new adult members. Everyone does. For many congregations, this is a passive system of receiving adults. For others, it is the responsibility of the pastor. For others, it will take almost an act of Congress to change their methods. So there is some form of taking people in. But that taking them into membership is not the same as true assimilation, making them feel a part as one with the congregation. I want to share a diagram here because this when I saw it, and we all use it, this is a diagram on assimilation right here. You want to take a look at that real close. It's, I believe you have it. Yes, I've given it to you. You got new visitors coming to the church. And I put there your church. You can put your name into it. They visit. And you, all of us have visitors. I remember challenging some pastors at Coral Ridge to evaluate your visitors carefully. How many of them come one time and never come back again? How many continue to come back? Have you ever checked that out? And one pastor said, no, I never have done that. I said, it's very, very interesting that if you would make a study of your visitors who have visited maybe once or twice and never came back again, the place where you need to look automatically is very logical. There's something we're doing in the way we're conducting the worship service. They're not coming back. That's usually where it is. There's something there. And so visitors visit your church. The new visitors, we have a visitation ministry. That is, we reciprocate. They visit our church, we visit them. And we go back to see them, encourage them. Letter, almost every church I've ever been in mails out a letter and expresses appreciation that you were in the worship service on Sunday morning. But there is a visitation ministry. And from that ministry, see, they can come into the discovery class. That's why we had those channels. It wasn't always new members coming from the new member class. It certainly was a good number coming from Evangelism Explosion, and they were right into the discovery class. They weren't even members of a church, but they were already in the discovery class because we were concerned with assimilation. And from there, out of the discovery class, one of the other areas where we moved, of course, was into the small groups. When I got to the huge Coral Ridge Church in 1972, there were no small groups in operation. It was my responsibility to begin the process of developing those small groups. Now, these groups are, of course, one of the major keys to real assimilation is going to take place in a small group. Because some small groups are closed. They're not taking any more in. But when a small group is open, that new members can constantly come in and begin to feel part of that, you're going to have the end results you really want, where people begin to feel part of what's going on. And we could draw diagrams to show that basic situation there. Biblically, of course, we can see this same process. And I wanted you to turn to Acts chapter 2. I just want to mention a little bit about this, how it all goes together. As I was studying in preparation to develop the discovery class, the Lord definitely led me to this Acts chapter 2 passage. And I know you're familiar with it, but I just want to take a look at a couple of little things in here and remind you of them. Of course, there were multitudes that were converted on the day of Pentecost. From among the multitude, 3,000 received Christ as the direct result of the outreach of the New Testament church. This principle of outreach again is repeated in verse 47, where it's continuing to go on. It says, and the Lord added to the church every day those that were being saved. There was a constant addition coming, more and more coming. This process is going on ever since the day of Pentecost. And I want to just show this to you in another diagram and just look at the principles. I believe this one is also on your page, basically here. You'll notice is that it says they gladly received the word. That is, they were converted. They came to Christ. They were baptized. And that, of course, can vary according to different denominational backgrounds and all, but it's part of it, becoming part. Then they were added to the church. They joined in its relationship, in the congregation, in the body. They were instructed by the church, verse 42. They continued in fellowship with the church, verse 42 to 46. They reached out into the community, and of course, they grew in numbers daily. You have that diagram. And by the way, you'll notice it's a circle with an arrow on it, which means the process continues to go on. It's consistently going on all the time. Looking at those principles, I was able to develop that class and begin to feed it out, feed the people through that class. The actual entry into the fellowship circle of the congregation. Let me draw this another way, and you can see it and understand it this way. And that is basically, you have two circles in every church. This outer one is the membership circle. Membership circle, right here. That's everybody on the rolls of your church, the membership. But the fellowship circle is the one on the inside. These are the people involved in its life. They are the ones that feel a part. They have been assimilated. There's a real relationship going on, and it's thrilling to see this happen. Every church is identical to this. Now, we're going to talk some more about those things to make sure it's clear. The actual entry into fellowship circle congregation can be illustrated like that. The larger outer circle represents every member as a member of his circle. That's those that are part of your congregation on your rolls. The smaller inner circle are the members who feel a sense of belonging and full acceptance. They're part of it. It is from this circle that the leadership of the church will come. That's where your leaders are coming from. The people respond out of that. And, of course, the other thing we showed you on the other diagram was they were constantly reaching out into the community. Let's look more closely. I'm Roman number three now. Let's look more closely at this process. The visitation ministry, as I showed you on the other diagram, in our case, I'm speaking from my own experience, at Coral Ridge, the visitation ministry was evangelism explosion. Automatically. In the church, we had a sign-up system as people visited, and churches use all different varieties of plans. In our church, you have a folder that's in the pew, and you sign in that you were there. At Coral Ridge, they used cards, and members filled the cards out and made sure visitors next to them received it and filled it out. Those cards then were put into a process for a call, and one of the teams in Evangelism Explosion would call upon them. That was our church visitation program. And through that call, we were able to determine whether the person was a Christian or not. And very often, many of these people would come to Christ, as I've said earlier. A lot of them would come to Christ. The next process was to go into the discovery class, even as the diagram said. That's where they came. And that just that time of welcoming them and sharing our life. And I taught that thing consistently. I trained another guy for the other one, and it's still going on. And praise God, it's working. It really is. That's it. That's what I was talking about. It's the essentials of new life. This is it. The eight lessons are all in there. And as I said earlier, there is a leader's guide. I could get you a Xerox copy of it. And how to conduct it. The School of Hard Knocks is in that book, by the way, because I learned an awful lot in the early days. Now, the third area we noticed on the big diagram was the small groups. I began a class training leaders for small groups. I taught a 13-week course. Later on, discovered I could cut it back to 8 weeks. And we recruited people that wanted training to become small group leaders. And I went through that training. The first 4 weeks was teaching by me. And the next several weeks, we were working together doing different things. I would say, John and Mary, next week, you take the lead. And I'd tell you, the next week after that, someone else. So they were beginning to get experience in leading the group. We were going through the actual material. It was identical to our 2-7 series clinics, where the people walk their way through that book and cover all that's going to be a part of those courses. They walk their way through, and I was doing the same thing. And as a result of that, 20 people took the training. 12 of them said, I will be a new leader. Well, now I got 12 people who want to be leaders of small groups. We were going to use the Navigator series designed for discipleship. Now remember, they're coming out of my discovery class and could be simultaneously in a small group at the same time. What we need to do is think of time periods. The discovery class was Sunday morning during the worships, the Sunday school hour. Small groups were Monday evenings or Monday mornings or Tuesday evenings or Tuesday morning, anything like that. It could be any other time during the week. That's when they held. And so a person would not only often be coming to the discovery class on a Sunday morning, but we were able to get them into a Bible study group or a small group and study. And we had it divided between single men and single women and couples, and we did it all kinds of ways. Sometimes we did hardly anything. We had get acquainted coffees. We organized a bunch of those where the new convert could just come to a home. And we found the power of inviting a person into someone else's home. And people of means with very large homes and very fine homes would open their homes, and we'd have a get acquainted coffee in there. And the only thing that we shared was about 15 minutes, something spiritual, but helping people to get to know each other. And that became part of that assimilation process and the bonding that took place right there. The small groups, like I say, we had the Bible study groups, and we trained some 20, 12 started. And from those groups, as people were recruited in the new member VIM class, when they signed on the clipboard, "I want to be in a small group," I would call them and get them into a group nearest to their home. As we began to multiply, we were able to do more and more of that. And it tremendously helped them to get into the small groups. And I know you guys understand what I'm talking about right there, because many of you have the same thing underway. But the small group is where the real work of assimilation is done. That's the best. In the church I was in on a consultancy last July, a year ago, in Houston, they had 26 sub-congregations scattered all over Houston, Texas. No wonder this church was healthy, because they had activities for their membership in different areas across the city where they could join. They didn't have to come downtown, all the way back downtown to the local church, but they were scattered all over that city. And in studying it, some of those people would travel anywhere between 23 to 25 miles on a Sunday to get to the church. So the small groups really work for the assimilation process. There are the youth fellowships. There is the women's organization, the men's organization, the prayer groups. There were several prayer groups that were started, and these were older, more growing Christians, but that relationship that continued to develop. The adult Sunday school classes, they're keys to assimilation. Our church, First Press, we have 19 adult classes, and of that, we have about 25 to 2,800 people on a Sunday morning in Sunday school. So we got a lot of big ones. There are some of them that are, one of them I know is 350 members, and it must be about seven of them that are 250. That's huge Sunday school classes, but they really work. But the assimilation goes on there. That makes them feel a part. The strength of that is really so powerful. It could be a group of 10 or 12 in a smaller class where it's taking place the same way. And the choir, the ushers, others, all these groups. But particularly with new Christians, we had the small groups that were Bible studies. As I said, we had Get Acquainted Coffees and these others. And from the 12, we went to 20, and then we continued to go. And when I left, there were 58 groups in operation. And some of those were 2-7 series groups. And that is, of course, very exciting, because today at Coral Ridge, there are some 22, I believe, 2-7 groups in operation, multiplying from the original. In a church of 100 members, there should be at least 6 or 7 groups that people can join. At least 6 or 7 should be in operation. Small groups. There can be different groups, like the women's fellowship, the men's fellowship, you know, they could be the women's missionary group or something like that. They could be men's studies, couple studies, single studies. But there should be at least 6 or 7 out of a church of 100 where they can go. That is the key. Groups would divide by sex, age, and purpose. They divide differently like that. And it's the key to it. However, becoming a part of a particular group gives a sense of belonging and fellowship. The groups are organized and developed to meet needs. And you heard Frank talk about that, meeting needs, very clearly. I can speak of my own church because we've been in it 10 years. We have the Divorce Recovery Workshop at First Press, and it's a big, big thing. There's 200 to 300 people that sign up for that thing. It lasts several weeks. It's a special group, and people from the city, not even members of our church, they flock to it by hundreds, and it proves to be a great source of evangelism. Beautiful. There is the codependency workshop also, another one. And these are younger people that grew up in a home where mom or dad was an alcoholic. Both of them are alcoholic, and the results of that. And you know what's going on there. There was the growing through grief workshop, another one. Huge things where hundreds come. And as you listen to Frank and his church, you can hear more and more of them that are developing where people can be brought in and reached that way. All of these are prospering, and they're growing because the intended purpose is ministry outreach, to provide for the special needs of these groups of people. I was, as I said, I was primarily responsible for developing the small groups that were Bible study groups, not necessarily need-centered. And we tried to train our people that they would be sensitive to other needs that would show up in the lives of these people that were joining their groups, because we had to realize the vast majority of them were relatively brand new Christians, and they were bringing all that excess baggage with them into it. And when you have the situations where they open up, what a power it is. And I've led groups. I had a group on Monday night at our home. And one of the beauties, when I was out in Evangelism Explosion, I could always tell somebody, by the way, I have a class at my own home, and I want to have you come to this tomorrow night, or whenever it was, you know. And I said, if you need a ride, let me know. I'll come pick you up and bring you. My wife and I dealt with the couples. I had a single girl lead the single girls that came, and I had a single guy lead the single guys that came. So it worked very well for us. That was mine. And that's a good thing to do, by the way. If you're heavily involved in evangelism, you ought to have a small group Bible study going. So if you lead people to Christ, you can bring them right into that channel as well. And it helps tremendously in the assimilation. A Tuesday night, I would go to Miami in a navigator ministry, because I was not only full-time on the staff of the church, but I was a full-time navigator representative. And I was told by my boss, he said, Francis, sitting south of you is 3 million people. He grabbed me my collar one day, and he pulled me right close to me, looking straight in the eye like that, and he said, sick 'em. Well, young girls training to be nurses were coming to that Bible study. And then we started picking up others from other churches. But the relationship was so beginning to develop among these people. So I got to know more and more and make them feel at home, and they would continue to bring new people in. And that's the same way it worked in the church. This is a navigator ministry, but the same way it worked in the church. But we were primarily concerned with getting people into the Word, because I wanted to make sure, as I said earlier, I didn't want them to head toward the pew and sit for 40 years. I want to train people to become disciples. And so we exposed them to all those biblical principles that related to discipleship. Now let's talk about entrance into membership. Lyle Schaller, by the way, I got a book here somewhere. Where did it go? Did it get away from me? Here it is. This book by Lyle Schaller, S-C-H-A-L-L-E-R. He's written a number of books in the areas of church growth, and you're probably familiar with him. I remember reading Looking in the Mirror. It was a classic. And this one on assimilating new members, the insights that he has, I highly recommend it to you. And by the way, it should be available down the hall. And if it isn't, you know, purchase it at your local Christian bookstore. But I wanted to make sure you had this one. This one here, a lot of insight into the assimilation process. I recommend that very heavily. He indicates in his book, as far as entrance into membership and assimilating new members, in his book right there, he mentions four major avenues of membership. That is, if you draw a circle which represents a local church, there are four avenues through which people are coming in. They're coming in through friendship. They know somebody in the church. And we all know, I remember Dr. Kennedy saying, when it came to increasing the membership of the church, he first turned to us guys, and he said that each one of us would be bringing 5 new members every membership class into the church. And as I said earlier, man, you live with that thing 24 hours a day, and it almost becomes like trying to find your trainees for the next semester in Evangelism Explosion. You're always looking for somebody and trying to recruit. And I was in the meeting, and I turned to Jim. I said, Jim, there's another level of leadership in this church we're letting off the hook. And he said, well, who's that? I said, well, that's our elders. There must have been 80 of them. I said, why can't we ask the elders to bring one new member every membership class into this church? Jim looked at me. He said, Francis, you're learning. And then he preached a sermon. And he used an illustration of a guy that brought into membership in his church over 1,800 members for only one reason. He invited people to come. And they tell us by statistics, I think I'm right on it, 65% of people join a church simply because somebody invited them to come. So the membership is through friendship. That's one way. There's kinship as another. Relations. When I went to Fort Lauderdale in May of 1972, I went down there to meet with Dr. Kennedy and tell him that we were the couple that the Navigators were sending down. I spent an evening with him. We went to the worship service, a great time. There was no question about the fact that that's where we're going to go. And we moved down there, and we got there on a Saturday. The next day, we're in the worship services. We talked to Jim again and all. And I remember saying, by the way, my wife has been a choir director, and next we got to have her in the choir then. So she's already recruited in. She was in there, and in 2 weeks they gave me a Sunday school class, and I'm a navigator. Now, you have to understand that. I'm always looking for men to disciple, period. I live that way. And I recognized that I was an unknown. They don't know if I can teach the Word of God. They don't know nothing about me. But they asked me to take a class. A woman was teaching on the Gospel of John. And I figured, well, here's a nice fishing pond, so let's take it. So I took it. I taught it almost a year, and that was before the New Life class was born. But I taught it for about a year. We went with, I think it was 16 we started with, and in less than a year, it was about 85 or 90 people in that class. But I was going fishing, and I found a bunch of men to invest my life in through that class, and it just worked very, very beautifully. And God had worked so marvelously in it, because we were studying John, and for the 3 years previous with the key men in Charleston, South Carolina, guess what we were studying? We were studying John for 3 years, so I was very ready to teach that class. So there's membership into the church by friendship, by kinship, and then there is the pastor. People are attracted to the pastor. I remember one Sunday we made a study at Coral Ridge. The membership was 4,200. Actual church members present was 3,500. But our attendance was 6,600. You figure out how many visitors we had. And they were attracted because of Jim Kennedy. They either see him on television or something like that. And sure, they're going to fill out a card, and they become sources for evangelistic calls. And we were able to lead a number of people to come to Christ. And then the last one, last type of people come into membership is the walk-in. That's people that just, you know, they're used to going to churches. They've moved into your neighborhood, and they're looking for a church home, so they just walk in and see how they like your church. And it goes that way as things tie together. But Lyle Schaller in his book points out that the vast majority of new members can be classified under two terms, that is, friendship and kinship ties. Most of them will come that way, the vast majority. There is a lesson, of course, in this. The congregation that wants to grow should look at the friendship ties and how they can be increased between those who are members and those that are not related to any local church. That should be a key. What can we do there if that's true? I remember Archie Parrish, some of you know who I'm talking about. He was the executive director of Evangelism Explosion. He now has his own organization in Atlanta called Serve International. One of the areas where he is working in outreach ministries is training people how to come from the incognito stance, where most Christians really are, really, into a place where they're boldly sharing Christ among their relatives and friends. And Archie seems to be doing quite well there. The routes of inclusion into the church, we need to take a look at that. What happens to the adult who does not have any kinship to the congregation? Which members quickly gain a sense of belonging is another question. Which ones drop into an inactive role? In a typical congregation, adult members fall into five categories within 1 year of uniting to a local church. They will fall into that natural pattern. There are five of them, and I'm going to share them here with you. A typical local congregational adult members fall into those five categories. Number one, they can become part of a group in a face-to-face relationship that is meaningful before they join in membership in the church. They're part of a group. That should tell us something. Choir members join often the choir before they join the church. Those in Bible study groups later on will also join. Those that come to Sunday school classes later on will join. In my class, of course, there were so many of them. They came, they felt part of it. I didn't share with you, but you know, the way we structured that new believers class, I told everybody to put a date on the top of his handout notes so that he knew, and it said class number one or class number eight, whatever it said, and had a date on it. Let's suppose in a couple of weeks they miss a class. I said, you can figure out when that next class is going to fall because we never stop the cycle. And they could figure out if they missed class number three, what date it would fall on, come back and take it. And there were people that came to that class and not only went once through the eight cycles, but went twice through it. And when we left the church, they had a big farewell party for Norm and I, and hundreds of people came to us and said, you know, Francis, the foundation of my Christian life was in that class. That meant a lot to me. Because I know in the 5 years that I taught it, I know that almost 1,200 people went through those eight lessons. That's a fact. And it was assimilation that was going on. Secondly, they who join a group after official membership. Either way, some come into classes or groups and then join, but then there's the others who become official members and then join a group. These people are brought in to feel a part of after membership. As I mentioned, the VIM class was one of the key things we did to help people understand this is now your church. And you need to know what's going on here, all the various ministries. So we had everybody come and share what was going on. We had the Boy Scouts come. We had the Awana groups. You name it. And they gave handouts and all that kind of stuff. And that really helped people to get into those groups. Thirdly, others are assimilated by accepting a role of leadership. Norm and I, as an illustration, my wife and I were there 1 week, and by the next week she was in the choir, and within 2 weeks I was teaching a Sunday school class. I mean, we were brought into leadership almost immediately. And for the first year that I was there, I taught that class, and I began to organize Bible studies, and I recruited key men to spend every Saturday morning from 7 to 9 a.m. with me. And we met for 7 years, those same times, around the clock. I recruited those guys personally because I wanted to invest my life in some men. They were already Christians. They were already leaders in the church. And we spent that time with them. Seven of those guys today are pastors. Two of them are foreign missionaries, and all the rest are leadership in the church. Danny Repko, who led the meeting this morning, has one of those guys at the Lake Avenue Congregational Church in Pasadena, California, teaching a class. He was with me 7 years. His name is Bob Kelly, and he teaches this course at Lake Avenue Congregational Church for new Christians, brand new babes. So some accept leadership role, and they're assimilated that way. The sense of responsibility helps tremendously. Number four here, some accept tasks or jobs in the church that help the person gain a sense of belonging. In the ministerial interview, everybody was interviewed in a ministerial interview. And Dr. Kennedy was so sharp when it came to evangelism, he would give out a card in the new member class. The two questions from Evangelism Explosion were on that card. And everybody had to give an answer to those two questions. And he would get them back. The person's name was on it, but he would never reveal the name of the person. But he would go through those, and he would often share, well, now here's one that has the wrong answer. Well, you know, as he reads it, the person will eventually probably figure out who it was, but he didn't give their names. And then he would go into why the answer was wrong. But those cards were stapled to the membership application, and all 11 of us pastors on the staff of the church, we would have a certain amount that we would have to interview. And I always comically said to my secretary, give me an hour with the dead ones and a half an hour with the live ones. And we dealt with them. And I remember one class with Reverend Bill Swetz. He and I were the only two ministers there on this particular time during a couple of weeks in the summer, and the class was going on. There were about 70 people in the membership class. We split it in half. I had 35. He had 35 to interview. And of the 35, I led 17 of them to Christ in my office, which was very difficult to understand after all that I knew was being communicated in that membership class. But in the interview, in the new member interview that I would give, one of my responsibilities was to ask the person, okay, now where are you going to be involved in the life of this church? And we would fill out on the form what they wanted to do. And some people said, I want to take the evangelism training. I told you earlier, that was the church's visitation program. And we understood that. And so I would take all those names that were recruited that way, turn them into the evangelism office, or I kept them in my own personal little diary. And people in EE would come to me and, Francis, do you know anybody who could be my trainee next semester? Because they were always looking for new recruits. And I said, yeah, I got about six people. Could you give me one? I need one. So I give name and phone number, let them recruit them to be part of their team for training. And that was exciting. But accepting a task. And some says, yes, I've been a teacher for the last 15 years, and I'd like to continue teaching. So I turn that name over to the minister of education in the church. Or I want to work with youth. Or I'm just willing to do volunteer stuff. So we'd put them into that category. But we tried to recruit them into some place where they could serve, because that helps to assimilate. It helps to make them part of the congregation. The remainder of new adults do not fit into any one of these categories. They just don't fit. Lyle Schaller, by the way, in his book speaks to this, and he says, the adult new members who do not become a part of a group, accept a leadership role, or become involved in a task during the first year tend to become inactive. So we've got to recruit them in to do something. Even if it's an assistant to a teacher or to play a piano in a Sunday school class, when the little kids are singing or something like that. Get them to do something. It will really help tremendously. Okay. I'm coming to a conclusion. I still have a few more things after that to share with you. Assimilation is a process that includes many critical factors. The most concise is the attitude of the members of the church. There must be a clear understanding between wanting to grow and deciding to grow. The enthusiasm level of the congregation is critical here. It's easy to detect that growing congregations are, one, enthusiastic about their faith, two, about the church in which they are members, they're enthusiastic about it, and three, about the life program and ministry of that congregation. They're enthusiastic about everything about it. And it's easy then to draw people to come and to help them become part of it. They have intense convictions about their call to reach the unchurched. Frank mentioned this morning very clearly the difference between a strategy-centered ministry and an event-centered church. The event-centered church is quite easy to figure out. Just go look at the calendar, how it's been filled in with all the events that we want to see happen in the year that's coming in our local church. All the events. I remember I was in Fort Myers, Florida, speaking to about 30 ministers in a ministerial luncheon, and I was talking about the different types of discipling courses in the local church. I don't have that diagram with you this morning, but it was very interesting that as we study it, if we would really recognize our adult Sunday school classes, 95% of them have turned into nothing more than a lecture, and we wonder why we're not producing disciples. We're not doing it. A little 20-minute message turned into about a 2.5-hour session, and I challenge these men, go back and look at every one of your classes. What is the way it's being taught? If it's a lecture, no wonder you're not growing. No wonder you're not discipling. There is a place. That's why this was taught mostly on a teaching type course. It has its place with brand new babies to teach them. And I think that's biblical according to Acts 2:42. They were under the apostles' doctrine. They were being taught what it meant to be part of the body of Christ. And that's why I taught it this way and opened it up for discussion. I often had people ask questions, brand new Christians, and wanted to know. A lot of them didn't ask anything, but you could tell you were communicating. And things were getting across. But as they grow spiritually, we must shift the plan from a lecture to more involvement. And that's why Evangelism Explosion and the 2-7 series is so effective. Because there's cost involved. There's money to be spent. There's homework to be done. You can't have the take-it-or-leave-it attitude. If your Sunday school classes are so structured, and most of them are that way, where people can come if they want to come. If they don't want to come, they don't have to come. Just challenge in anywhere, and you're not going to get in. You get what you inspect, not what you expect. And it'll work that way. The capacity of a congregation to receive, welcome, and assimilate new members is an important price tag for growth. How capable and how much capacity does your congregation have to receive, welcome, and assimilate new members? That's the price tag of growth. Number three here, as a conclusion, the size and variety of the group life must expand in proportion as a congregation increases in size. Can you imagine how many small groups we would have to have at a huge church like Coral Ridge with 8,000 members, or Bill Hybels' church with 14,000 now? It's huge. It really is. And yet, it's not realistic to have that many. You can't have it. We tried. We worked on it. We keep, pushing hard, recruiting, doing everything we can to increase the number of small groups and get people into there. But a church like Coral Ridge, which has so many activities, it becomes difficult to come along with something else which you know has tremendous value and get people into it. Because at Coral Ridge, you had that huge choir. You have the classes on Wednesday nights. Our church right here, First Press, has a thing they call Getting Together Wednesday Nights. You know how many people are on Wednesday night? About 2,500. That's a lot of people taking classes. But it seems like that's working, and it's helping. But the small groups where you can get down to a more personal level, that's where the real assimilation is going to go on. That's where the real growth is going to take place, and it works so well there. An essential component of the decision by any local church to grow is the recognition that any person's decision to receive Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, the decision to unite with a local congregation, and acceptance into that congregation by the new member are three unrelated, separate, distinct steps. They're separate, and yet they're part of one. Too often, they are assumed to be one and the same. Here at Coral Ridge, and I'm speaking from my experience in my own church here and all like that, there was so much results in EE. A lot of people weren't living there. They just came down during the winter months. Visited church. We visit them. We share Christ with them. We lead them to the Savior. And many received Christ who never joined the church. And there were all kinds of reasons for that. A growing congregation must expand its professional staff and support staff to accommodate for its growing membership. Too often we're trying to do the job with too few staff and too little a facility. And we have problems with that. That's why it's crammed and tight. So you must expand proportionately as it continues to grow. I think we know all of us know that here. Now, I'm willing now to open it up any questions, and I want to share a couple more things with you, and we're just about through. Any questions? Here's the chance. Yes. I know. Each church conducts its worship service different ways. You can tell even by denominations the difference right there in the way they conduct the service. Well, I'm only speaking about my personal convictions. I have personal problems with the pastor and his assistant constantly going on with things on the platform. Carrying conversation on, like that. I think we should sharpen it up even more. That's just personal. I'm not saying that to criticize anybody. I have problems with that. I like to see things, click, 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 click. And the assistant knows when he fits in and everything like that. At Coral Ridge, we had telephone between the two of us, and we were 45 feet apart. And Jim wanted to say something to me, and remind me of something I needed to pray for in the pastoral prayer or something like that, he'd call me. Usually he would talk to me even before I went in, and it was pretty well settled out. The choir director knew when things flowed and everything like that. But I do know that in talking to people that there's something going on in that worship service that did not attract them back. It can be the way the congregation received them, whether they showed friendship to them or expressed, we're delighted you're here today or something like that. It is a critical factor. Right there. There's something there, because that's all they're being exposed to so far is your worship service. So something may be going on there. I've been in churches, and I know I didn't want to go back. I just didn't care for the way it was conducted. And you listen to Frank this morning. He's talking about the service upstairs compared to the one downstairs, see? And that's the price of growth that we've got to decide, which is some people more comfortable with the one was upstairs than the one was downstairs. And that's interesting. That really is. Yes. Thank you. You know, some people come to church, it's just about a denominational loyalty. When they move from one place, they go to another church of the same denomination. And they don't even think about it. They just figure, I'm Southern Baptist, so we'll go Southern Baptist. If I'm Methodist, I'll go Methodist, or whatever it is. That's another avenue. Yes, you got a question.
I just want to make a comment. For me, it's a fine line. No major evidence.
Yeah.
And to me, there's a danger there. The pastor can say, they're here because of me.
Right.
And if he moves or he or she moves or whatever, then those people don't come back either. Right? It seems to me that it's a little messy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We cannot deny the fact that some people come to a given church simply because they've heard about that pastor, and that's been a key all along. Absolutely, been a key.
Well, I personal testimony, and I'm in a church of 200 members, and a lot of people came to that pastor. He left last year. And everybody said the church was going to fall apart. But he had steered the people to Christ. And so we may have lost one or two families. But they think they're coming because of the pastor, but then they realize, in a sense, you know, they come because of the family.
Well, I follow that pastor. He did. Because of him.
Okay.
I've never been in a situation where I've been a pastor's brother.
Off the record, let me just share another side of this whole picture. And that is, because of my books and being out in publication, they were printed a number of years by NAV Press. And then NAV Press let them go, and I had to get another publisher. The cover has changed. They're the same identical book inside. Through about the last 8-9 years, I've been holding seminars across the United States on the re-emphasis on disciple-making in the local church. I used to call it disciple-making in the local church. And Rich Cleveland and I, in producing a brochure, I want to hear a copy for you, we produced the brochure and we called it Essentials. And you'll notice it's called A Seminar on Discipleship. I am deeply concerned, personally, as God has opened doors, for the thousands of churches across this land that have lost their mission statement. They exist 50, 70, 80 years, some of them even younger than that, and you can tell they've lost it. I was just in two Lutheran churches this spring, and it was a battle. It was a battle because they lost emphasis on why do we exist as a Christian church in this given community. And that mission statement for a church to be really making headway today, they must be strategy centered. And part of that strategy, I am convinced, needs to be the membership know why that church exists. And when your membership don't know why you exist, and you could preach a series of sermons on that, you'll be surprised what's going to come out of that. And to me, it's a loss of this vision of disciple-making. Frank was eloquent this morning here when he pointed out, you know, church planning. What is it, church planning, or is it go make disciples? Which one is it? It's go make disciples. Jesus said, I will build my church. What a difference there is when you recognize that. And the Lord has just opened doors. My seminar, I'm hoping to get it up to about 25 a year. Right now, I've done as many as 18. I have one of them in 2 weeks. I have one in November, and I'm working on about 6 of them for next year, and there'll be more coming, I'm sure, since then. But what I want to do right now is just pass these out. If one of you guys could help me, I want all of you to have one of these brochures, just so you know what's going on. And my emphasis is on on discipleship. It's based on these books and redefining what does it mean to be a disciple. How does that process go on from convert to disciple maker? How can that happen in a local church? And I think we've made that pretty clear. The seminar is usually a weekend from Friday night through Sunday, or it could start on a Sunday and go through a Wednesday with the meetings mostly in the evening hours. I'm the only guy that speaks. I travel anywhere. I've been all over parts of Canada and all over the United States, and it's been very exciting. 2 weeks ago, I was in Abilene, Kansas, in a Methodist church, and what an exciting experience that was to be with them and encourage them, because they were doing quite well, but the re-emphasis, to take a good look at it again, is key. And so this all ties together in the assimilation process. Any questions on that? We're about through here. Well, I thank you for this, for being here today, and it's I hope it's been helpful. I tried to put this together. Like I mentioned, Lyle Schaller's book. There may be a few of them right down the hall. If not, you can purchase it from your local bookstore, and you can learn more about this tremendous subject. Thank you.